Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, A Night with Jana Jihad, on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Literary Arts, presenting author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates in celebration of his new book, The Water Dancer, Monday, October 21st at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, in conversation with author Renee Watson. Tickets and more information at literaryarts.org. And now it's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with Jacqueline Keeler.
Okay. That was Portland artist Catherine Paul, who is a Swinomish tribal member and a musician here in Portland with the band Black Belt Eagle Scout. And that was her song, Indians Never Die. And I thought that was a good lead into our show today on Wednesday Talk Radio. This is Jacqueline Keeler. I am a journalist based here in Portland, Oregon. I am also a Native American. I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation and born for the Yankton Sioux Tribe. And today's Wednesday Talk Radio is actually about Trump's racist tweet. And I'm asking all of you the question, have you ever been told to go back to where you came from? And I have to say, even as a Native person, an Indigenous person, I've been asked, that question. I've been asked, where I originally am from. And of course, ironically, being Indigenous, I'm originally from here. And there is no other country, other place in the world for me to go to. And so part of this for me is talking about, from my perspective on what Trump was saying on Sunday when he tweeted out to progressive congresswomen, and of course he's referring to New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other progressive women of color who have recently entered Congress, including Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, and Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and implying that because they are brown, they're not from this country. And this is from a man whose family only arrived here in the early 20th century, and whose mother was born in Scotland, right? And whose wives have also been immigrants from Europe, and he basically told them that they should go back to their where they came from, basically, and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. And yesterday, the House actually voted to condemn his racist tweets, and four Republicans and one Independent did join the Democrats to cross the line. The vote was 240 to 187, which is very few. This gives you an idea of where the Republicans are at this point. That they refuse to condemn the president for such incredibly virulent and divisive language, and he's doing this, of course, to activate his base. They enjoy this kind of talk, and they are they still have the votes to put someone like this in office, and that's the reality of America today. I think that and it does make me think more about we were told for so many years that this was a minority point of view, that only a few people were this racist, right? And yet with Trump we have seen the real outlines and shape and how numerous the quote-unquote silent majority really are, and their votes are heavily weighted. He lost Trump, of course, lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, but he still won the Electoral College vote. And this is the way in which white votes are heavily weighted far more than the votes of people of color and people living in urban areas. And they still have a lot of say about who is going, how this country is going to be run. And yes, hi, we have a caller, Lou.
Can you hear me?
Yes, hi, Lou. Okay.
So, good topic. I wasn't sure if the talk radio programs were going to cover it this week on KBOO, but it sounds like you are, so that's good. I'd say individually, well, I had a parenthetical question. Do we know if Paul's actually gone or if Paul's coming back for Wednesday morning or he's just gone or we don't know? Paul Rowland, are you still there?
Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, Paul will be back, and he's right now in Italy. He's part Italian, and his family still go back to visit family, and that's where he is right now this summer. So I guess that was the end of the. We lost the caller. Okay. Yeah. And so, we are. KBOO is tackling the subject. Trump basically, telling members of Congress, people who are elected to represent this country, many who were born in this country, I think, and about countries, brown countries being not run well. And of course, this completely ignores the history of colonization and the sort of meddling that happens in other countries. I think if you've read Noam Chomsky's books, and you can see the way in which the U.S. policies overseas have for hundreds of years sought to destabilize other countries. I mean, this goes back to the Monroe Doctrine, President James Monroe, declared that this hemisphere was going to be under the power and control of the United States, and they were going to be the first ones to be able to meddle in other people's other countries' politics and rights. And and I think that one of the I mentioned earlier that I have been told to go back to my country, and in a sense I do have a country. I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, right, which is within the boundaries of the United States, but my father is Yankton Sioux, so that part of my family are citizens of the Great Sioux Nation, right, and all the various tribes. But I think we often don't contend with the source of that power. I think Trump telling people, and if he was told to go back to Germany or Scotland, where his family are from, his excuse would be that those countries are well run, right? And this is the sort of racist underbelly of how Americans, many Americans, white Americans, view the success of their country, right? And the subsequent success of many countries in Europe. They don't see the ways in which this is directly tied to colonization and the sort of assumption of wealth from other countries and the destabilizing of these other countries. And a lot of this, I would actually trace back to the doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is not well known to most Americans, but it is actually the legal basis that the United States uses to claim the land that it occupies. And the doctrine of discovery goes back to a couple of papal bulls from the Vatican, from the Pope, in the 15th and 16th centuries, and basically states that only discovering European Christian countries have the right to claim title to the land. And so what this means is that when a Christian discovering European country lands on your shores and plants a flag, they basically have all the title to the land magically reverts to them. And so for all people who are not European, who are not Christian, who they don't have title to their land. And this was the basis, the legal basis, and it's still legal basis. As recently as 2005, the Supreme Court ruled in City of Sherrill versus the Oneida Nation of New York. They basically ruled that based on the doctrine of discovery, the Oneida Nation didn't have title to the land. The city of Sherrill, New York, had taken out a 100-year lease on its land from the Oneida Nation back in the late 19th century, and in the late 20th century, that lease was done, and they had to renegotiate it with the tribe. And the tribe was, I guess, they had thought the tribe would not be around. They had negotiated the lease for $1 a year for 100 years for the title to the land that the city was on. And so their title to the land was clouded at that point, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Oneida Nation did not have title to the land because of the doctrine of discovery. And this was this majority opinion was actually written by Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, notorious RBG. And so European countries have benefited from not having interference in their affairs. I mean, even a small country like Norway, which controls, oil fields in the North Sea, which is the source of its wealth, they could not militarily defend that. When Germany invaded them in World War II, they fell. And many countries in Europe don't have the military might to defend their sovereignty, but their sovereignty is respected. And this is something that is not true of many countries around the world, where the predation of their countries and their economies is an ongoing, project. Colonialism and imperialism did not end in the 19th century. It continues to this day. And so so when we look at other countries, and of course with, Representative Ocasio-Cortez, with Puerto Rico, that is allegedly part of the United States. Was taken over during the early 1900s, and the Spanish Empire was breaking up and many parts of it were declaring their independence from the Philippines to Puerto Rico. And what happens, the United States sails in with its great white fleet and basically forcefully takes over these places and turns them in the case of Puerto Rico into a territory. And we see with what happened with the devastation that happened there recently, that Trump is not keeping any kind of giving the money needed to repair those countries, to repair Puerto Rico. So the idea that somehow they are responsible for this, and folks like him here in the United States are not, is an incredibly privileged position. And so I thought that I would also read a bit about my experiences of being told that I was foreign. And so please feel free to call in the phone line in the studio. The number is 503-231-8187, and let us know if you have ever been told to go back to where you came from. And I have to say, as a Native person, this has happened to me because I am a brown woman. And what does this say about our country? Where are we at? We're a pluralistic society. What does it say that this can still, be such a generate so much support for the president from his hardcore followers? And I wrote a piece called "Foreigner, No Country for Me." I was in high school and walking with my friend Camilla, an exchange student from Norway. An adult asked me, out of the two of us, what country I was from. I'm Native American, 13/16 according to the official certificates of degree of Indian blood issued by the U.S. government to my parents. My father was 5/8 Yankton Sioux, and my mother 4/4, that is full Navajo. But I knew he wasn't asking me about the 3/16 of European ancestry I possess. He was asking me if I am from France. He wasn't asking me if I was from France, England, or what is now Germany, all places my ancestors left to make new lives for themselves here in the New World. He'd assume that because I am brown, that I am not from here, not American, and assume my blonde Norwegian friend, whose ancestors had never even lived in this hemisphere, was an American. That one question made it clear to me that no matter how many thousands of years my ancestors had lived in this land, I was, to many white Americans, like this man, a foreigner in the only land I could call my own. Because to him, to be American was to be white. And yet, I do have a country, a nation, a people. I am an enrolled citizen of the Navajo Nation and born for the Ahantuman Dakota Yankton Sioux tribe. And when we both told the man the truth, that I was Native American and Camilla was Norwegian, I don't think it truly altered his initial perception. I was still not American. I was still a foreigner. And for blonde Norwegians, the door to be American was, to his way of thinking, open wide. And to be fair, she hardly had an accent on her English. And she could be absorbed into America without any thought or awkwardness. My grandpa Keeler fought in World War II, serving in the Pacific. His father, my great-grandpa Henry Keeler, fought in World War I, even though he wasn't a citizen of the United States. A Yankton Sioux tribal member, he, like other Native Americans who served in the U.S. military in the Great War, did so even though the U.S. regarded them as resident aliens, citizens of indigenous nations defeated in war, whose lands had been taken to create this new country. Okay. All right, we have a caller, so I will stop reading. I'll continue it after the call. Hi, George.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for reminding us that the people who discovered America were the First Nations Native people who came here in, what, maybe 10,000 or 15,000 years ago and became the first residents, as far as we know, of South America, North America, Central America, the Caribbean. And I wanted to ask you just one question. We've heard talk about crime-infested places from whence people came. Would it be fair to say that the corporate world now is a crime-infested multinational conspiracy against justice? Of course, people will argue, but I'd just like to ask, is there someone who wants to consider this? And so I'll hang up and listen to the discussion.
Yeah. Thank you, George. I would say yes. I mean, I actually was posting an article earlier this week looking at Trump's mob ties, his actual ties to the mob. And I mentioned that when I was 18 and I got my first internship working at a magazine in New York City, I was being driven by the cabbie and we drove by Trump Towers. And he told me, the cabbie said, everybody knows that Trump is just a front for the mob. He said he was a blonde Aryan front for the mob, and no one can work in construction and not work with the mob. And these are very well documented ties that he has, and even many people who have been working with his administration. Thinking of the fellow, this is his name, Setter, who helped actually try to negotiate the Ukrainian peace deal, have very documented ties to the mob. And I think that, and even historically, many very prominent American families, like they got their start with the opium trade, taking opium to China. I think that the line between, what we consider, criminal syndicates and the ruling class, and I would say even feudalism was a form of a criminal syndicate where, William the Conqueror comes with all his friends and take over a country. There's an element to power, to the way it's exercised, that is not always what we would consider legitimate. So we have another caller. Linda?
Oh, hello. Yes. Hi, Jacqueline. When I heard the comment on the radio, the very first thing I thought of was the Native American experience. And I've been reading pretty much all of Sherman Alexie this past number of months. And in one of his books, he has, I think it was after 9/11, he has a character where some white guy is like yelling at him to go back to your own country. And he says something like, you first, or something. It's really funny. And I've really been very educated by reading him and also listening to you. So that was the first thought I had when I heard about the Trump comment, was how the Native American people were probably laughing, or maybe not. But
well, thank you, Linda. Yeah, that's a good point and a good quote. Kim. Kim. Okay, I think we lost Kim. All right, and Suzanne. So I don't hear Suzanne. Okay. Well, yeah, I would speak to that whole point. Okay. All right. Yeah. I will speak to the point of this is I think the whole aspect of being viewed as a foreigner in really the only land that you can call your homeland, which has been my experience. It's pretty profound. I think. Most people don't even, the Navajo Nation, of which I am a citizen, is the largest Native nation in the country. It has a land base the size of Ireland. It has a population equal to that of Iceland. But most Americans don't even know it exists. Like, they'll go to the Grand Canyon And they won't even... Okay. I think we got Kim back. Hello, Kim? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
Yes. Hi, Kim.
Tim.
Oh, Tim. Sorry, Tim. Sorry.
Anyways.
Yeah.
I'm calling because you wanted to hear from some people who've been told to go back where they came from. So, anyways, I've been told to go back where I came from when I was an organizer at the Sisseton-Wahpeton Reservation in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the apple side of the tribe who didn't want me there because we were working with poor and elderly, and then the racist white infrastructure who didn't want any Native people to find out how to organize and assert their rights, defend themselves. And so there was parts of the tribe and parts of the white, or well, all of the white infrastructures about, who had told me quite clearly to get out of town, along with our other organizers, but we didn't. And later on in Peace Corps in Paraguay, I was working with small farmers down there, and elite infrastructure didn't want me there. But I convinced them it would be to their benefit if we worked together and cooperated. Yeah, so that became okay. But those were the two instances where I was told to get out of town and go back home.
Wow, and so when that happened on the Sisseton-Wahpeton Reservation in South Dakota, so this was both, you called them Apple Indians. So you're talking about apple is a term in Indian country where someone is red on the outside but white on the inside, right?
You got it.
Yeah, it's kind of a,
derogatory
term, yeah. Can I ask, are you Native or?
There's a family legend, but I have no.
Oh, okay,
DNA.
Okay, yeah. So you're not from, yeah, yeah. That would be, and this was, yeah, this was back in the 70s. You said the 1970s.
1980s.
Oh, 1980s. Wow, yeah. 80
to 82.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's pretty extraordinary. Yeah, I am. I'm sorry to hear that. I know that change, was really something that's been a long process, and power structures. No matter really, who is in charge, often become very self-serving, and the goal of trying to create a more equitable society is to create structures that keep, opportunity, that keep accountability for everyone, and that is also needed in Indian country. I have to say we're not perfect. We had social structures that were very good, but were dismantled through colonization. And largely dismantled, and yeah.
Some tribes more than others.
Yeah, I mean that's, you can tie that back to the boarding schools, what children were taught or was beaten into them, that sort of self-hatred, and that definitely plays out in our politics.
In the same way, sister, white people, black people, they had that same kind of crap, but in a different way, beat into them.
Yes.
Don't think any of us are born full of hate. I think, if anything, our tendency is to love and want to be loved, right? But we learn that hate. We learn that intolerance. And that's the same thing as ripping an Indian child out of the womb and subjecting them to this foreign, hateful culture and not letting them grow to be the human being they could be.
Exactly, so, exactly.
It's all of us. All of us need to change how we think, how we feel, how we love, how we, I don't know. I'm just getting off on it right now.
I totally agree. And I think that's exactly what we need to be bringing to the table right now in confronting the kind of language and the sort of mean spirit that Trump is channeling and evoking and giving life to, political life to in this country right now.
Are the tribes unifying now in response to Trump?
The tribes, they've been, they have many groups, that they work through to provide a unified voice, whether you're talking about the National Congress of American Indians or locally other local coalitions. But definitely, because they're all affected in similar ways. Trump is basically, going to, he has a thing about Native people, and a lot of it's tied to his experiences in the casino industry. He testified before Congress in the 1990s, saying kind of the same thing about Indians, saying that these Indians don't look like Indians to me. Talking about tribes in Connecticut and places like that, where he was being hit, the market was being challenged by the entree of Indian casinos, and in his own bankruptcy, and so you definitely feel like he's trying to he's at war with the with Native nations in this country right now, political war, defunding programs. Threatening, slashing sacred sites, bringing in more, oil and gas development, and even now uranium mining, everything, a real assault on tribes is going on. And so that does unify people when you have to fight something like that.
Hey, do the tribes have a Native-oriented training center, organizing center that trains people to become organizers?
There's been initiatives, but I don't think that we have something, nothing like the what is
it? Acorn used to be, or something like that.
Yeah, I think we definitely need something more like that. I covered Standing Rock, and I saw there was a lot of organizing going on there, and teach-ins happening at the camp. But yeah, we could definitely always use more. And there are different groups that do community organizing. I was trained as a community organizer in the Southwest, and worked with a number of tribes there when I was just out of college. So yeah, I think that's a really valuable skill, and the lessons I learned working directly with various Native communities really they inform me to this day in my work and my writing.
I remember the Campaign for Human Development. You know who they are?
No.
Catholic Church. Back in the 80s, they used to fund 3-year projects, seed projects, to get things going. That's how we funded our organization initially. I bet you they would love to read a grant where the tribes unified together and made a proposal to fund a training institute so that Native people from all over the nation, maybe all over the New World, could come there, train, organize themselves, specialize in specific issues, like environmental or women's rights or whatever, and then go back to their countries and start organizing organizations and training others.
That would be great.
Imagine the change effect that could have, especially if someone was coordinating the work of those people. After a few years, man.
Yep. Well, thank you. Oh, sorry. Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate your work in our communities. And,
okay.
And
long
yeah.
Life.
Yeah.
Take care.
Definitely. Okay. So I don't know if we have any callers. We're having a bit of trouble with our phone lines. It appears that we're dropping calls. Please keep trying to call in. You can call in at the number here in the studio is 503-231-8187, and you can call into Wednesday Talk Radio. And we want to know, have you ever been told to go back to where you came from, and what this means? Trump, what this means to America today, that we have a president that would say that to elected officials, to congresswomen, all based on the color of their skin. And and certainly, there are, I saw some a white congressman tweeting about the fact that he was actually born in another country, but nobody ever tells him to go back to that country. And if you could call in, the number is 503-231-8187. And we had a lot of interesting calls already this morning, and I want to thank everyone who called in. And the question of, you know, how we got to the situation, how we got to the situation where there are a lot of white Americans, people, Americans who consider themselves to be white, because, of course, that is a social construction created in the United States, you know, a caste system, and how they came to perceive other, for brown people, as basically, it appears, not having, you know, needing to clean up their mess, basically, and not recognizing the role that countries like the United States, who viewed themselves as discovering countries, colonial countries, imperialistic countries, the role these countries played in destabilizing these other you know, economies, and the way in which elements like the doctrine of discovery, where they say that because you're not European, because you're not Christian, you don't, and because you're not the discoverer, right? You don't have title to your land, and the fact this is still active law, even you know, the House which admonished Trump for saying these things, you know, have they called for you know, for the you know, for have they condemned the doctrine of discovery, which is still active law in the United States? And as I mentioned earlier, this law was derived, you know, from papal bulls, you know, the Pope issuing edicts in the Vatican. I think one was in 1492 and one was in 1550. And these were basically declared that only discovering countries that were European and Christian had title to the land, fee simple title to the land. Everyone else, the people who were being discovered, they only had, you know, the right of use of the land, like what the animals possess, use and no title, and so this is still ongoing now. I had mentioned the case of the city of Sherrill versus Oneida, New York, which was decided in 2005. That was only 14 years ago, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the. The decision, and in that decision she cited the doctrine of discovery that said that the Oneida Nation does not have title to its own land, and so I think that this emboldens this imperialism, this right to interfere, to go into other countries, you know, and to do what we want, not we want, but what these discovering countries want to do with these, and you know, we worry now about, you know, the Russia probe and Russia interfering in the U.S. government, and you can see in which the way this sort of interference, you know, this alleged interference, you know, can make it very difficult to govern, can make it very difficult to have an orderly democracy. And there's a long history of the United States, you know, going overseas and you know, overthrowing governments that are not in the best interest of corporate America, and this sort of destabilization of these countries is really ties into the ways in which and why people have to flee these countries. And so I think not knowing the full story definitely leads to this misperception in Middle America that brown people cannot rule countries, and this is the exact sort of hateful speech that Trump is actually bringing into the discourse, not only nationally but internationally. He's saying this because, of course, he's heard around the world. Okay, we have another caller.
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne.
And I live in Salem, better known as Snalem. my mother, second cousin, was General George Custer, and he murdered many Native people in this country. He loved that killing. He was a very sick man, and my mother went out of her way to say to me and my sister, we needed to not try to cover something up or think that we won't talk about a very nasty relative like Custer. But no, she said, you must take responsibility for your family's history. And that was a very important teaching for me. And my mother, who was born and lived in western Montana, she went out of her way to take me to as many Native ceremonies as she knew about, and including I got to visit the white buffalo at that time, which was he lived along Flathead Lake, and Mother would read all the stories that she could get her hands on or that she knew about the sacredness of the Native American tribes. And I felt that that was part of my responsibility to my children. Mm-hmm. And to the Custer, the battlefield, etc., etc. But what really troubles me, I married a wonderful man, but from an all-white family in Michigan, and he had no exposure to the real history of the United States, and certainly not of the Native people. And I just get now, I feel I've turned away from the corporate women families that I happened to get to know when I was in college at the University of Michigan. And some time ago, I called these women, they're all white, my sisters, but I said, I can no longer keep company with you if you choose to host our sisterhood only in your gated communities.
Wow.
I don't do that. And I've not heard from any of them since. That
wow.
was at least a couple years ago. And I want you to take some kind of heart that there are people like me that do tell the very speckled history of our relatives. And I've gotten now so there's nothing that works but love.
Yeah,
and
I think
stop the listening, because if you think listening is hearing, you're wrong. If you hear, you act. And we have so many paralyzed people in this country. They may give tolerance some sort of token.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's a bunch of lies.
Yeah, I wonder, how do we have that conversation when, you know, like you were mentioning, people are walling themselves off from each other, creating these sort of white enclaves where if they see a person of color, they'll call the police. You know, I mean, we just saw Eric Garner's.
I've taken on now the gadget stuff. And no matter where I am, if I'm, you know, in a store or in a restaurant and I see somebody with a gadget, right up against their faces, usually.
You mean
and
a cell phone?
I'm very outgoing, and I'll say, hi. And I'll sort of lean down, you know, and look at the person, and then they look at me. And I say, that's good. I wanted to see your eyes.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of this for me is structural. You know, I think people do things because this, you know, they're in a it's almost like they're in a maze, and that maze, you know, like a rat in a maze, and it leads them in certain directions of thought, directions of what they can see and what they can't see about the world. And I see a lot of these structures, you know, like living in an entirely white neighborhood as really making it difficult for them to see other alternate points of view. And then also people now pick and choose, you know, who they hear. So they end up in sort of an echo chamber, right? And reinforcing some of these ideas. I think, how do we, you know, and I would like how to also, I also like to commend for...
I really feel that anybody, I don't care what ancestry they have, we need to revisit what our current actions are and be serious about that. And that's why telling our stories, so-called real life, you know, stuff, I think that is important to gather around us some willing people like me or you to actually sit down and talk out loud about things that we're wondering about. Oh, should I, you know, investigate this or investigate that?
Yeah, well, I'd like to bring this back to our original discussion about whether or not you've ever been told to, to go back to the country that you, and I think, you know, it's part of what, you know, of course, you know, your ancestor was doing was to make, you know, and of course, you know, my ancestors fought Custer, you know, at the battle of Greasy Grass of the Little Bighorn. And I've been to that battlefield as well. And actually, my grandmother's cousin wrote a book called Custer Died for Your Sins. I don't know if you've ever read that book. His name is Vine DeLoria Jr.
I'll write that down.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say to you, too, I am reading the book of The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee.
Yes, by David Truer. He's married to a girlfriend of mine from college. In the Indian world is very small. You know, he's Ojibwe. She's Iroquois. Yeah, it's a very good book. I'm getting back to the title of the book that my grandma's cousin Vine DeLoria wrote, Custer Died for Your Sins. And you know, I think that title is very interesting. It's a very good book. It was written in, 1969, and it's called An Indian Manifesto. So it was sort of leading into the Red Power movement. And it's very interesting because the title actually kind of draws it back to the system, the structure of which he was a part. You know, he was a part of a structure. You know, he went to West Point. They were taught, the book that they were used to train with was, of course, Julius Caesar's book about conquering the Gauls. You know,
and he graduated the very bottom in his
class. Yeah. And you know, I think that it's this idea of them being like Caesar, Julius Caesar, to come out here. And when Caesar conquered the Gauls, who are now the French, right? You know, they, you know, it's sort of the similar idea they were coming here to. So it's, I think America still has not fully contended with it or even given up that mythology, because incumbent on what Trump was saying is that what they have is superior to what people of color have, you know, or capable of society.
I carried this Truer book. I've been up to Seattle a couple of times in the last month since I started this book. And I've carried it on purpose, not just to read it, but I flip into the prologue and show that mountain of bison. And that is the jackpot, because I've had mostly, I don't want to see that.
Yeah, well, that is an amazing, it's an image of all of the, is it the skulls of buffalo that were wantonly killed to basically cut off the food supply for my dad's people, for the Dakota and Lakota people, so they could not live on the land anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so it's quite a horrific image. And you know, now that you mentioned it, I should probably have David Truer on my show. I should do that. I should remedy that. There's another great book that came out too about by Dina Gilo Butler. She wrote a book as well. I should probably have them both on. They're both great Native writers.
Yes.
And
yes.
I respect them very much. And it would be really great to, yeah. No. But thank you so much. And I think
thank you very much.
Great talking to you.
And I really say we've got to act and be and behave our values. And sometimes, you know, that gets kind of hairy or lonely. But a finished note, my husband was also white, as I am, but he was a very good jock. So when we moved to Salem, he was a doctor, but he wanted to play golf. And I said, go ahead. He said, well, we will join the country club. And I said, no, we won't. I couldn't stand it. But, you know, and that went on back and forth in our relationship all the time.
Well, I think we're almost up against time right now. So, but I'd like to thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah.
Bye.
Okay. All right. Bye. Yeah. So, we have been talking. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Jacqueline Keeler. I'm a Native journalist based here in Portland, Oregon, and we've been asking the question whether or not you have ever been told to go back to where you came from. This is, of course, something that Trump tweeted over the weekend, and at progressive, you know, Democratic congresswomen, and of course, he's referring to the Fab Four, you know, women of color who have entered Congress and are making, obviously, they're making some inroads, you know, and kind of, you know, getting to him, which is probably a good sign, but it does, you know, the lack of, you know, the House, of course. Issued a resolution condemning his tweets, but the Republicans, most of them, voted against it. And so it's obvious that the Republican Party, is banking on Trump's racism in the upcoming 2020 elections to turn out their base. And what does that say about their base? What does that say about this country? And so we've been having a conversation over the past hour about this. I'd like to thank everyone who called in. I think that, and I mentioned, as a Native woman, with no other country to go to, I should say, except for this one, and my nations are the Navajo Nation and the Great Sioux Nation, the Dakota Lakota Nation. You know, they are all located within the boundaries the United States claims as its own land, and I do feel quite strongly that the impunity with which Trump feels entitled to speak this way, even though his family have only been in this country since the turn of the 20th century. I mean, they weren't here for the Revolutionary War. They were in Europe still. They weren't here for the Civil War, you know, and I think that no one in his direct line has ever fought in any American War. I think his uncle fought in World War II, but he himself, you know, got out of the Vietnam War with bone spurs. You know, his father and his grandfather never fought in any American war, and yet he feels completely entitled to tell other people about this being his country, right? And that's totally based on him being white. And I mentioned in the piece I was reading from earlier, which I've written about this foreigner, No Country for Me, how my grandfather and my great-grandfather Keeler, they both served in World War I and World War II. And my great-grandfather Keeler actually served in World War I when he was not a U.S. citizen. Native people were not granted citizenship until the 1920s, after World War I, and partly in response to their service in World War I. And they were basically resident aliens in this country. And they did not really truly get to exercise the vote because of racism until the Voting Rights Act passed in the 1960s. And so when you look at my family, the white side of my ancestry, I'm 3/16 European, I have ancestors who served in every war, in the Revolutionary War and in the Civil War, I have an ancestor who was a brigadier general. But when people see me, they see a brown woman and they assume that I'm from somewhere else. And that's completely based on racism and the denial of, the indigenous nature of this land. And when I look at people who are from, indigenous people who are from Central and South America, they are from this land too. I mean, how did their ancestors get to Central South America except traveling through this land? And I remember one time I was in the, I was in a grocery store and a woman came up to me and she spoke to me in Spanish and I was like, I'm Native American. And she was, she apologized and she was, and I told her not to apologize because, that her ancestors, that this is her land too. And that her ancestors' bones are buried here as well. If you go back to, 10,000 years, her ancestors' bones are here as well. And she looked at me and it was just such an amazing moment. She was obviously indigenous as well. And that felt, I being able to tell her that she is from here was an incredible moment for me. And it felt right. They are our relatives, and I've had the honor of traveling, in Mexico and these are, I felt at home there. I never had to explain to anybody who I was. People didn't even ask where I was from if I didn't speak, they didn't hear my accent. They just assumed I was from there. And that's a privilege that I think white Americans don't understand, to be somewhere and not to be questioned about your right to be there. And as you see with the shooting deaths that's been happening, and Eric Garner's, the recent decision to not prosecute, his murderer, the police officer who choked him to death. You can see that being brown in this country and being black is really dangerous, and it can mean life or death. You don't know if you're safe. I mean, basically, white people have ruled this country through terror, and it's through terror that they maintain control. And to be brown is to live, in a state of terror, under terrorism. And I think that Trump is using, the language he's using is calling that up, is activating it, and the Republican Party's refusal to condemn him for those words show that they are invested in this kind of terrorism, and so I think that's my take on this this week, and so I once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler. I am a journalist based here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Native American, and you can read my writing in many outlets. I've been published in everything from Salon to the New York Times, and my Twitter is at JF Keeler, and you can check out my blog Tiosh Baya Now, which we will link in the page for this show. Great talking to you all, and I look forward to talking to you next month. I'm usually here on the second Wednesday of the month, co-hosting the show with our regular host, Paul Roland, who is on summer vacation in Italy, and we look forward to having him back in a while. So thank you all.
Tune into KABU Wednesday, July 24th from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. for the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon. Broadcasting from a different city each year and airing on non-commercial radio stations coast to coast, this annual marathon features live reports, interviews with advocates and experts, and calls from listeners all over the country. This year's programming includes the voices of youth, students, and LGBTQ people, panels on fighting evictions, transitioning people back into housing, and ending homelessness now. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Wednesday, July 24th from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time now for Radio Zine.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Aisha Chowdhury, and today on Making Contact.
The more I understand U.S. history, including early U.S. history, the clearer it is to me that this country, this economy, is a house that torture built.
You'll hear from Rebecca Gordon about the legacy of torture in the United States. We didn't just start locking people up and torturing them after 9/11. The United States has always used torture to control and to punish.
The real purpose of torture is establishing and maintaining the power of the regime that takes on the torture. They don't torture everybody. There are certain groups of people who are identified as legitimate targets of torture, and generally what makes them legitimate is that they are separated from the category of ordinary human beings. These are people who are subhuman in some way.
And by better understanding torture itself as a tactic of control, we can better understand how to fight back against places